Blog Talk Radio. Good evening, everyone, and welcome to another Friday night's edition of Center Stage. I'm Carrie Hines, your host. That was Money, Money, Money by the OJs, y'all, and I thought it was so appropriate for tonight's show. We've got a great show lined up for you tonight. We're going to talk about some things tonight. First, we're going to head off with the Federal Reserve, and then we're going to talk about stories straight out of the headlines. Y'all, we can't even make this stuff up. So that's what we're going to do. We have a new segment that we're going to implement here on the show, just stories straight out of the headlines. So we're going to try to, on a weekly basis, hit some of the top stories that we hear across the country, not anything necessarily local, but stories straight out of the headlines from across the country. But tonight the guys are with me. Listen, and I always enjoy when the guys are with me because I feel like I'm just kicking off my shoes and just hanging out with people that, you know, you can talk about anything with. And tonight, Mr. A.J. Houston is back in the building, and also Mr. Christopher Bonds is back with us this evening, and I always enjoy hanging out with these guys. Absent tonight is Mr. Carl Mitchell. Mr. Carl Mitchell had to work, y'all, and so we three are going to try to hold it down. So good evening, Carl. Good evening, A.J., and good evening, Christopher. How you doing?
Good. How are you?
I'm
good.
Everybody doing all right?
I'm good.
Doing all right? Good.
Doing good. Doing great.
You know, y'all, we're opening up with a biggie tonight when we're talking about the Federal Reserve. And you know, I don't know what you all's research has been this week, but, oh, my God, when I look at the Federal Reserve's website for, you know, their, you know, a description of who the Federal Reserves are and what they say the Federal Reserve does versus what other sites are reporting is quite different. Did y'all find that in your research?
Well, it, you know, it has to be different because, you know, a lot of people won't do the research.
Right, right.
So why should you have something different on your site than you have on anything else? Because, hey, you want everybody to stop at your site and that's the end all be all.
True. Well, you know what, we can start right there. The Federal Reserve's basically, you know, and we're going to talk about what the Federal Reserve says versus what others are reporting. First of all, the Federal Reserve says that basically the Federal Reserve system fulfills its public mission as an independent entity within government. It is not owned by anyone and is not a private profit-making institution. Others are reporting differently, y'all.
Well, Jefferson reporting differently.
Oh, what, who's reporting differently?
Jefferson. I'm saying back in the day, everybody had a problem with the Federal Reserve. They wasn't involved in it.
Exactly. You know, it turns 100 years old on the 23rd of this month. And what I understand as far as them not being privately owned, they are actually owned by some very wealthy families, and that it is privately owned, and that there's like 10, and we're reporting this. Let me give my sources. First of all, Infowars.com is where we're getting some of this information from, and also we're getting information from Peter Kershaw, and he's with Economic Solutions. So those are our sources tonight on this story. But they understand, basically what they're saying is the Rothschild family out of London, the Rothschild family out of Berlin, the Lazar brothers, Israel Schiff out of Italy, Tan Loeb Company out of Germany, the Warburgs out of Amsterdam and the Warburgs out of Hamburg, Lehman Brothers out of New York, Goldman Sachs out of New York, and the Rockefeller family out of New York. So who do you believe?
Well, it's owned by a conglomerate. It's owned by a couple very super wealthy initially individuals, but now big banks or corporations that in a joint unison kind of like agreement basically own the Federal Reserve out of New York, but then there are 12 sub-banks underneath the Federal Reserve. So it's there's the one person saying that it's not a private bank, others saying that it is a private bank. Well, it is a private bank, but it's a system that is set up that is not solely a government treasury or Department of Treasury asset.
Mm-hmm. I agree. And, you know, they have a 6-member board, y'all, and basically and I'm looking for my notes on this. They explain how they are really not necessarily have to answer to the president, which I found very odd. And I'm looking for where that is in my notes because I would have thought it says, as a nation's central bank, the Federal Reserve derives its authority from the Congress of the United States. It is considered an independent central bank because its monetary policy decisions do not have to be approved by the president or anyone else in the executive or legislative branches of government. It does not receive funding appropriated by the Congress, and the terms of the members of the Board of Governors span multiple presidential and congressional terms. So, you know, when you say you don't have to answer to anybody, that sounds like, or any government entity, doesn't that sound like you're privately owned?
Absolutely.
Well, it sounds like a kingship.
The exact definition of privately owned.
It sounds like a kingship, but see, the reason the wording can be changed in this day and time is because, you know, a couple of years ago, corporations became people.
Yeah.
So now.
And you're exactly right. You know, one thing I found out, that somebody had a breakdown of how they make their money or how they print the money, basically, and then once they print the money, how it breaks down into what it costs the Federal Reserve to print the money, what it costs them to print it, and then what they make off of it. And it's crazy. And I'm going to break that down if y'all got a second. Now, this is going to blow your mind. You might get your pens and paper ready because this blew my mind. It says, if the Federal Reserve wants to print $1,100 bills, their total cost for ink, paper, plates, labor, etc., would be approximately $23, according to Dave Kidd in Why a Bankrupt America. So then he says, if you do the math, the total cost of 10,000 bills would be $230. So he said if you take $10,100 bills equals $1 million. So the Federal Reserve creates $1 million, then lends it to the U.S. government with interest for a total cost of $230. That sounds like a business I want to go into. That's crazy math.
Well, and when you think about it, why should the taxpayer or the federal government have to loan itself money from itself? It's one thing when you borrow money from China, when you borrow money from Britain, but essentially what is happening is that this, and that's why it is a private entity, because if it was the government itself with a centralized bank under the Department of Treasury, there would be no need for that. That would just be a holding facility for the money or the notes or the bonds. But in this sense, in order for the government to get something, it costs them interest.
Yes.
From themselves.
Okay, but let's imagine this. Well, first off, I'm glad everybody's here, man. I really appreciate everybody showing up on Fridays, man. It's off the chain. I enjoy the show, man. It's almost like when I'm performing on stage. I'll be so hyped when the show is over, I have to sit down and chill out. But I just want to make sure that everybody agreed to, you know, give who's ever talking an opportunity to finish their point. And let's just make one point at a time, each one of us. And then we can keep the show flowing. That was what I wanted to say right there.
Okay, well, you got you. Listen, I promise I'll go there with you. But let me ask you this. Does it seem fair that, especially in light of our debt, you know, being what it is, I think we're at $17 trillion now or something to that effect, is it fair that really are not printing our own money? Is it fair that we have a private entity making that type of interest off of us and we're not printing our own money?
Terry, everything else that's 100 years old starts getting weaker.
Mm. Wow.
This has solidified itself so many times over that everybody just accepts what's being done. It's almost like, you know, the guy to get out there and say, well, he thinks the it's going to be a bear market or whatever you say, and then you see the stocks change just on his say. And they have control over how things go just on the thought on what they perceive is going to happen. So the Federal Reserve is even stronger than that.
Would we do better? I mean, you know, there are several people. I think is Congressman Henry Gonzalez, chairman for the Banking Committee. He's been introducing legislation to repeal the Federal Reserve Banking Act of 1913 nearly every year, and he gets nowhere. Is it something that is too big to fail, if you will, or is it just too much money behind it for it to ever go away?
Well, it can, but see, you have so many people making money from them making money that the lobbyists are paying everybody this illegal money. Because I mean, when you're a senator or a governor, or then when you make it to the House and you make it to Washington, there's so much money you get for speaking engagement. Mm-hmm. It's not the money that they make being there at the House of Representatives or in the Senate. It's the money they make on each speaking engagement, and those are the companies that hire them. Hey, if you do this for us, we'll give you 10 speaking engagements this year. You might only speak for 5 minutes, make $200,000, $250,000. So
true.
You can't trace the money as far as what they're being paid because they have other means and methods of paying them.
Mm. This is true. Because, you know, they said the same bankers who own the Federal Reserve control the media. And they give huge political contributions to sympathetic members of Congress. So like AJ say, they may not necessarily, you know, give them the money in cash, but they'll invite them to a speaking engagement where they'll pay them an outrageous $100,000, like you said, for 5 minutes or 15 minutes, you know, at the podium, gives them $100,000 plus expenses, which is just their way of keeping the book straight, if you will.
Yeah, equal compensation.
Wow. Chris, what are your thoughts?
Well, that's absolutely true, and I was going to add to that. To my knowledge, my research has shown me that there were only two presidents in the line that I personally think were assassinated specifically for their agitation of even considering disbanding or eliminating the Federal Reserve System privatization portion of it. But like AJ's saying, it's beyond the trillions. I mean, it's so much money because it's 100 years old. So this, if you could consider it like this, we're talking slavery, post-slavery, all the way up until now. Lincoln, President Lincoln and President John F. Kennedy were one of the only two that I know of, may have been others, but the only ones that I've been able to research and see that actually either were in the process or had signed Executive Order 11110, which basically the president has a litany of executive orders that individual can invoke. These two individuals had basically went into the basically signing of that executive order that would have done that. So if they were making that kind of money, and basically lobbyists back in 1880s as well, and 1860s and 70s and so forth, it's so much money being made that even presidents that go into office now, they understand that concept, but I can almost guarantee you a third to, I don't know, upwards to maybe 40% of what they have in their campaign coffer came from these folks. So they're in no position to then try to disband something that helped them to get into office.
I agree. And you know what? Now this is being reported on the Federal Reserve's website, and you all tell me if you believe this. It says the Federal Reserve is subject to oversight by Congress, which often reviews the Federal Reserve's activities and can alter its responsibilities by statute. Therefore, the Federal Reserve can be more accurately described as independent within government rather than independent of government. And
well,
I don't – do y'all ever remember a case in which the Congress pulled their coattails and said, hey, y'all can't do that?
No, the only thing, see, and that's, and AJ is hitting it on the point when he talks about how they change the verbiage or the what they actually say one aspect versus another. Yes, Congress has the ability to actually audit them, but Congress has never in 100 years audited the Federal Reserve. The only thing they do is they do an annual or a semi-annual review of the Federal Reserve activities. So they don't really do any kind of internal audit where they take folks from Capitol Hill and basically go to the Federal Reserve Bank and pull all the books. They don't do that. So, I mean, any internal governmental agency can basically be audited at any time. Mm-hmm. But the Federal Reserve has never been audited. So that's a red flag already.
You know what? And I'm surprised that they have that on their website. And their website, y'all, is like I said, federalreserves.gov. And I was surprised that they had that on there because I don't ever remember a time in my lifetime where someone said that the Federal Reserve was going to be audited. It just doesn't happen. It just does not happen. And so that was another thing that I found, you know, really odd about them. And basically 7 out of 10 of the shareholders are located in foreign countries. That's like 70% of the shareholders of the Federal Reserve are foreign. Does that seem odd to anybody, or is it just me? That means that, you know, basically the people that's running our monetary system aren't even – you know, American citizens, for the most part, because majority rules.
It doesn't surprise me because if you look at cities like Detroit, a little known fact, China is buying up so much of Detroit, unbeknownst to the people, that nobody even realizes that. And so, when a city like Detroit, just paralleling, when they come back, probably 40% of Detroit will be owned by China. And that's not even including some of the other countries that have come and started buying up properties and equities and so forth to actually interject money back into the city. So they have their hands in every kind of constituent money-making ability in terms of real estate and the Federal Reserve as well. I mean, that's not surprising to me.
You know, I mean, I guess I'm surprised that in the sense that we have no control over what's going on, and basically nobody's pulling their coattails. And so if we don't like it, we just got to deal with it or else. I mean, the Federal Reserve Bank, I understand, of New York is controlled by two banks, Chase of Manhattan and Citibank. That's who controls it. And mm-hmm. So, you know, if anybody is paying attention, the banking system is really shrinking and shrinking and shrinking. And we mentioned this on last week that at one time there were 1,800 banks, and now we're down to 700 and something and dropping every week. And so, you know, it's not, you know, rocket science to figure out that eventually we're going to have just a few big banks standing and everybody else is going to be gone, which we know whenever that happens, we're all in trouble.
But Terry, doing the bailout, see, the bailout was supposed to be an influx of money for the banks to renew some of the loans that were going bad because they saw what they had done. It was a paper housing market. But what the banks did when they got the money, they went and bought other banks.
Yeah.
Yep.
So you still see in any neighborhood you go to, you see all these houses. They're not even for sale anymore. It's for lease or for rent. Because
you know,
he mentioned
Detroit earlier, and you have ties to Detroit. Aren't there houses up there going for a dollar?
Well, not a dollar, but I'm saying there's so many houses that are empty. I'm saying the market is definitely, if you want to live there. But see, the problem is, if you get the house for a dollar, where are you going to get a job to pay the dollar next month? That's what you can probably move in for. But I'm saying, like my sister-in-law got a house that was a nice big house. But I'm saying the rent was cheap. She was leasing for cheap, actually trying to buy it. But it still needs repairs. But if there's no jobs there, so you get a job that's paying minimum wage, so now you can barely pay, you know, all your utilities in the house. So that's the problem with that market is there's a lot of houses you can get for cheap, but there are no jobs that you can get. Every job you get is paying cheap.
That's right. And to piggyback on that, and even if you can buy the house for a dollar, have a halfway decent job, but you yet can't keep up, whether it's in moving, most of them are not, may not necessarily be in moving condition, you got to put some money. The other caveat to that is that even if you don't have a mortgage, and you're still going to have the taxes and so forth, but most people won't really be able, the average Joe or Sally, won't be able to find a job because most of the infrastructure of employment in Detroit is broke and no longer there. So you have to have some money. So basically, if you have money, you're not buying those houses to live in them. You're buying them to either hold on to them until the market comes back, or you're buying them, fixing them up, and you're flipping them. Poor people are not buying them.
One other thing, Carrie, in Detroit, see, nobody noticed when they came out and they were attacking the unions.
Mm-hmm.
See, Union Central is the Michigan area.
Mm-hmm.
So if you attack the unions, then you get rid of the unions, so you get rid of the pay. So it affects all of America when you get rid of the unions. You get rid of the unions up there, and what they did is when they got rid of the unions, they made it to where the governor didn't sign that their pensions were secure the way it was, because they had this matching pension where you put a month and there was a match. So if he didn't sign that into the law, so now that they're filing bankruptcy, that's why all those people are losing money.
Okay, then let's talk about Detroit pensions, and we're going to segue there since we're already talking about Detroit. Let's talk about the pension system. So right now, as it stands, pretty much everybody understands Detroit is bankrupt. Well, that said, if you're a city worker, your pension is in jeopardy. Now, we did a show on this sometime back, and I forgot the name of the city. We do so many shows, I've forgotten. But we did a show on a city in Alabama where the city went bankrupt. And what eventually happened was they just went to the mailbox one month and the checks was not there. And they began to call the city, and the city says, you know, we don't have any money to pay you. We're bankrupt. And so the city filed bankruptcy, you know, went into bankruptcy. And what eventually happened after, you know, the workers, and we're not talking about just your average maid who worked 30 years for the city. We're talking about police chiefs and fire captains and people like that, and city managers and people like that. So these people had been like 25, 30 years on a job, some of them husband and wife working for the city, and you wake up one day and the checks just were no longer there. Anyway, long story short, after a long battle back and forth with the city, they ended up getting a third of what they were going to get. So let's just say they were going to get about $1,000 a month for their pensions. They ended up settling for $300 a month. And those people, and I'm going to go back and look in the archives, and y'all can go and listen to the show. I had 20-some-odd members of that city who had lost their pensions to come on this show. And we're talking about very proud people who had earned their living, who basically were reduced to having rummage sales and bake sales and people giving them handouts just so they could make it. And they were reduced down to a third of what they were supposed to be getting. So when I saw this story about Detroit, I really thought that's where it's going eventually.
But see, this won't go there, because what they did is, see, usually the governor signs this thing and, you know, everything's signed to where the pensions are secure and the match is there. But when they didn't solidify that it was going to be there, so when the bankruptcy files in bankruptcy, you have these people that you owe that have to be paid in bankruptcy.
Right.
So if they file bankruptcy, they won't be on the charter or the list that comes up that the city owes.
Really? So what's going to happen to their
pension? That's why they're saying it.
They're not going to get anything?
Well, that's what they're fighting for. See, I'm saying, but it goes back a couple of years to where this was like a setup. You know how you spend 3 or 4 weeks setting up the dominoes all over the house, and when you knock one down, they just fall, and it takes forever, but they fall in a row, and they make this beautiful little thing going on. This is that kind of setup.
Right. Well, Well, the name of this city, y'all, and I just thought about it, was Pritchard. Pritchard, Alabama was the name of that city, and I'm looking for what date that show, and you all can go back and listen to the archives. If anybody in Detroit wants to know how this thing is more than likely going to end, by the way, Pritchard, the Pritchard retirement plan was like this. You had a mandatory 10% that you had to put in each month. So imagine 20-some-odd years you put in 10% and you get ready to retire, there's nothing there. And that's exactly what happened to them. And so,
right.
And, go ahead.
And like AJ was saying, too, it really depends on what happens after the litigation for the city or the financier, the Department of Treasury, files the bankruptcy, and then once it's completed, because then that's when they then get to the terms. So even if the so-called union is trying to advocate for the people, the bottom line is that it's not so much advocating, it's what the courts are going to determine that the trustee has to pay those people, because that's how it ends up being invoked. So the bottom line is that you may have paid 10 or plus percent in every year, every pay period, and you, for example, may have been expecting to have maybe nestled away $300,000, let's say. Well, when they go to bankruptcy court, most of the bankruptcy cases for the city, the corporation level, there's going to be a percentage of whatever is remaining or what money is coming in that then will be paid out to that person, but that could be 60 cents on the dollar or less. So a lot of these people, in most of these cases, they won't be belly up, but this is going to cause a lot of these folks to probably either have to relocate and continue to work, because what they're going to be getting, $200, $300, $400 a month, and if you were anticipating getting $1,500 a month and now it's being cut by 40%, 50%, you're probably going to have to still work in retirement.
And, you know, and I thought about that scenario. If the city, you know, did or is doing them like that, is the city required, when a job opening comes available, that they rehire a retired city worker if they want the job? Should they automatically have to rehire someone that you know, has lost their pension?
I don't think there's anything in the law for Detroit that says that they have to do that, because once you're retired, and see, I think that's another thing they may have to litigate, but at this point, the only thing that they would have to comply with is the terms of that finalized bankruptcy in terms of who put in what and then what they would be paying back on the dollar, because that's the determining factor of what that person would be getting. But right now, I don't know anything that says that they have to rehire them because of the bankruptcy.
They should.
And
they should. I mean, if there's a job opening. And
you'll be a new hire.
Say what?
You'll be considered a new hire. Like, when you leave the job, they might keep whatever employee number you had, but you will, again, be a new hire, making the minimum of whatever they want to charge, you know, pay. Like, if the minimum wage is $10 to $13.99, they could bring you in at $10.
Well, that's like screwing you all over again.
No, yeah, I'm saying, but that's exactly what it is.
Wow. So you feel like the unions did not let them down?
No. The union didn't let them down. I'm saying everything was solidified. See, that's what I'm saying. When the Tea Party first started all their movements or whatever they were doing, the first attack was the union. Then it was the teachers' union. There's all these other things, because if you make the union seem bad, then you have it to where these were union places to where if you worked there, you had to join a union. In Texas, if you work at a place that has a union, you don't have to join a union, but you still get the benefits of the union. So if they disband the unions, what would happen is the union go and renegotiate every 2, 3 years, 5 years, whatever the contract is. Like, okay, we hadn't had a wage increase in 3 years. So we need a wage increase, you get the little bonus, you get all these other things added to it because the union fronts. And this sets the standard around the United States the way the minimum wage was increasing, because the unions were fighting, so every other state had to almost comply, although minimum wage didn't raise as high as they wanted to, it had to raise because the cost of living was increasing. Without the unions, the cost of living won't increase the way it was, because there's nowhere to base it off of. There's no there's no gauge. You see what I'm saying? There's no mile marker. There's no roadmap for anybody to follow because every company can do what they want to do because there's no unions. There's nobody fighting for wages. You're just fighting to keep your job. Because the union made it to where if they fired you, you had to go, you had a union rep, you had all these other people there to say, okay, why are you firing this person? So they could actually get your job back.
Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of things. Go ahead, Christopher.
I was going to say, and that is definitely true, and there's a book that I recommend if you haven't heard of it to get this book. It's called What Went Wrong in America. It's by the authors are Donald Bartlett and James Thiel. What Went Wrong in America? I'm telling you, I read this book. It's about, I don't know, maybe about 200 pages. But what it does is that it goes back. It was published in 1991, but it's like it's part of a 9-part newspaper series called America. But I'm telling you, this book basically dissects companies that were once very affluent and then why these companies failed, which it kind of talks about Detroit but other cities as well. The reason that Detroit ended up in the trouble that they did is that Congress passed a law that actually allowed companies to borrow money from different funds, and the pension fund was one of them. So actually, it wasn't so much of because of the economic downturn in companies and the market falling out. That was part of it. But the other part is that when the market fell out, most of these companies, GM and Chrysler and all, and Ford included, what they did is that there's a law, and I'll have to do a little bit more research, but I do know that there's a law that actually allows companies, because before Congress did not allow companies to borrow money. They didn't allow them. Once the person put that money in the pension fund, the company could not utilize it for anything else other than when that individual was ready to basically pull the money out of the retention, whether they did early retirement or left the company or they cashed in their 401 or their savings. But companies were borrowing money. In other words, they were writing IOU notes, taking money out, and never paying the money back. So as they pilfered these funds over the years, when a lot of these folks got to 20 and 25 and 30 years down the road, they didn't realize that their money had been borrowed by the company, the internal company, or that top 5% in the first place. So these are individuals that were already making horrendous amounts of money, and then they got Congress to basically let them pilfer money that they knew they were not going to pay back.
Mm-hmm. You know, Detroit is a tough cookie because, you know, the ex-mayor, Cuomo Kilpatrick, who's been on the show, you know, is currently in prison, and, you know, everybody blames the fall of Detroit on Cuomo, but I really have to beg to differ. You know, one or two term. How many terms was he in, AJ? One term?
I think it was in two terms.
Two terms. You know, you can't follow a city in two terms. I mean, really, it was in trouble. It had to be in trouble when he got there. And so, you know, when you look at this situation as far as the city is concerned, I don't know what the answer for Detroit is, but I just don't think y'all can blame it all on Cuomo. I just don't. I mean, this is my...
But Karen, it's easy to do. This thing back 5 years, when, you know, I always tell people, one of my favorite movies is Moving with Richard Pryor.
Mm-hmm.
And it's my favorite movie because he got this high-paying job to where they were buying him a house, they were doing all this other stuff, and moving his whole family up and all the expenses were paid. And when he finally got to the job, he sit down, sharpened a pencil, because the job he got, somebody had embezzled all his money. He sharpened a pencil, and these news people came in there with cameras asking him all these questions. And he was sitting there like, all I did was sharpen my pencil. You know, like, what are y'all talking about? Like when President Obama got in office. You know, all these things on. Then you had this market crash. You had all these things happening. So his whole plan went south because instead of fixing the legs and the arms of America, he had to pull out the paddles and try and keep the heart beating.
Mm-hmm.
But nobody saw that because it doesn't matter what you need fixed on your body. If you know if your blood pressure's up or if something's wrong with your heart, they can't do surgery. They have to make that stable first. So that was his first 4 years, is trying to stabilize the American heartbeat, which he had all these other things around him that wouldn't let him. So the same thing in Detroit. Detroit was in trouble before.
Mm-hmm.
But
it really
nobody saw the trouble because Detroit was walking. Mm-hmm. But the heart was failing. So when you get in office and you're trying to keep everything running and you're trying to, you know, fix the budget and you're doing this and that and it's almost working, but you don't really have an opportunity to see that you got gangrene in your leg and your toes are frostbitten. So you're going to lose all them.
Mm-hmm.
But you can only lose them if you keep the heart beating.
I absolutely agree. I think Kwame has there's a lot of similarities between Kwame's story and President Obama's story. I think that the real issue is they're black men who have power. You know what I'm saying? And so it's easy to blame them for everything. You know, everything goes wrong, it must have been them because they're a black man with the power. And I don't know if that's fair. I just, you know, that's
well,
just my
it's
take.
Not. Then I think what has happened again, in the case, all you have to do is look at any of the city or the companies in Detroit that went into a fiscal freefall. And I can guarantee you, if you do the research and you pull the books, that the mayor who was there, Kilpatrick, you will see that you're right. You will find out is that he had little, if any, to do with the city spiraling down. The city was in a free fall before he stepped in. But he becomes the scapegoat that's easy. And then people, it, kind of going back to what AJ said, a lot of people are not going to do the research. We know the government's not going to do it because it's not in their interest. But people are going to look at the easiest common denominator that's right before them and then basically blame him when it wasn't his fault that did it. This is it's big politics. These are people who have been basically doing this for years, and they know how to craft laws that then will insulate them when the money comes up missing.
Absolutely.
But it's not even insulation process. The thing is we should have learned in these last 5 or 6 years that the first lie is always the truth. When the Tea Party come out and they say something, and it can be completely wrong, Obamacare is gonna kill your grandmother. You know, all these other things. So now people heard that. So they didn't look at Obamacare for what it is, they didn't even want to research it. It was like, oh, man, I heard that's going to kill your grandmother. You know, so all these other things, just like when they said, oh, man, you know, President Obama is a Muslim from Kenya. A lot of people still think that because nobody wanted to research it because the person that said it, they believed in that person. It didn't matter if they were lying or not. So the first lie is always the truth. Because the first lie, you have to spend all your money to dispel what's said. If somebody's suing you for something that you didn't do, you still got to go to court.
Yeah, yeah.
Kwame Kilpatrick did the show, y'all, in February of 2012, and he explained, he said something on the show I think I'll always remember. He said, you know, Carrie, today, I live in Texas, and he said, you know, every week they still report on me in the news in Detroit. You know, if something bad happens, some kind of way he's always tied to the story, you know, and I thought, really? You know, but that's just that many years removed. He's not the current mayor, you know, and he was still, you know, he said, you know, he would come outside his home and there would be photographers here in Texas, you know, trying to take pictures of him, you know. So, you know, I just don't believe that everything that went wrong in Detroit can be blamed on Kwame Kilpatrick. And also the name of that town again was Pritchard, Alabama, where the town went bankrupt and the people lost their pensions. And we did a show on that in February 25th, 2011. So just a year earlier, we did Pritchard, and then a year later we did Kwame Kilpatrick, and it's in our archives. But that will give you a very good picture of what's about to happen with Detroit. Kwame explained a lot of what happened there, and the Pritchard situation will show you what will follow. Those people were some of the nicest people. I spent, I think, a week putting that show together, and I met 22 of the nicest people that you ever want to meet, and they just couldn't believe that they woke up one morning and their pensions were just gone. But that's just absolutely what it was. And I really came to the conclusion that Pritchard was a dry run. It's a small little town, and I think they did a dry run on Pritchard and said, if we can get away with it in Pritchard, we can get away with it across the board. And I think there will be bigger cities like Detroit and other cities that will follow where they will have bankruptcies and people will begin to lose their pensions across the board. That I believe. County workers, city workers, I believe that. Do y'all believe that?
Well, I'm saying everything's a dry run. I'm saying just like the, you know, the president and the attack on the unions and the attack on, I'm saying everything in America is under attack if it's not something that they want, on abortion rights, on, you know, even female health care, even all these other things that were normal, even laws that were passed 20, 30 years ago, they're trying to, you know, change those. So everybody said we can't do anything, but if you see that how many members the Tea Party have and how much strength they have, all that they got money, I'm saying, but we have money too. We spend billions of dollars a year in this American economy, but we are not a band group. We don't have the masses behind us. We're so reactionary, we wait till something happens, and then we want to get people together and take buses to this place and, you know, and show that we're unified. And then after that, we disperse like water.
Yeah. And you know what, AJ, you're absolutely right, because I didn't know it, but Black America spends over $1.1 trillion a year. That alone, I mean, that's a staggering amount. And, I mean, I read an article that further went on to say, it says that if you took that $1.1 trillion and you put it against all the other wealth, nations, individuals in the whole world, that Black America would be number 11. So that's telling you how much money that $1.1 trillion is. But it's not staying in our community. And like AJ is saying, a lot of that becomes rhetorical. We will get on the bus and we will go protest. That's a good thing. But at the end of the day, when we're done protesting and spending money, traveling, staying in a hotel, eating food, and then coming back home, nothing's changed. Because there's nothing that we do, kind of like the Tea Party. See, the Tea Party is not just making some noise. Yes, they're doing that, but they're lobbying. They're pressuring congressmen, senators, representatives for their interests. They're even pressuring some of these to create laws or modify laws, not the Constitution laws, but laws that are on the books, some of the federal laws, some of the state laws. So they're doing it in such a way that they're, at the end of the day, they're not just protesting, but they're doing it in a systematic way that will address the issue, but then get changed too. And just protesting, just a little boycotting here or there, it may hurt somebody for a minute, but in the long term and in terms of futuristically, it really doesn't do a whole bunch.
But you know what? Since the civil rights movement, Black people have not had that spirit and that drive to make something happen. Since we lost our leaders like Malcolm and Dr. King, it just hasn't happened. And you know, speaking of, you know, how much money we spend and all of that in our fight, we do spend a lot of money, and we spend we don't even have a systematic way of spending it. You know, we don't spend it in our communities. We don't spend it on anything that's going to further our cause. We just spend it. And I was listening to you talk about the Tea Party, and one thing I see with the Tea Party is the Tea Party has truly come under attack. You know, the IRS has been auditing them, and, you know, they've really had a tough run this last 6 months. That said, I think our leaders will look at that and go, well, I don't want the IRS messing with me. You know, so I don't think we have that type of push anymore within our community where anybody's willing to stand up and fight for anything. I mean, I don't know the 10 people you can get that I know right now that I can say, you know what, there's a cause that I think is really worthy of us all jumping on board. I mean, and it can really be a worthy cause. I don't know that there's 10 people that I personally know that I could say, okay, y'all, what do y'all think? And all 10 say, yeah, you know, we need to do that. I don't know 10 people.
What's happened in society today is our attention span is the way it's always been. We just have more things we pay attention to because everybody's looking at at Twitter. Everybody's looking at Facebook. Everybody's going to all these mediums, the Xbox One, you know, the PlayStation. All these are games that hold people's attention, so you can't see what's going on around you. So the thing is we have been so greedily entertained when we thought we made it. Just like you said, we haven't done anything since the Civil Rights Movement. Because just think, if you were going to Georgia, but you didn't know what city you were going to Georgia, and you drove down 20 and we made it to Georgia, you just stopped.
Mm-hmm.
You still hadn't made it anywhere. That's us. When we thought we had got us some free, thought we had attained what we needed to attain, but nobody had any direction or plan map on what we were exactly trying to do once we got that. So once they said we had it, it's almost like the McDonald's commercial that used to be on years ago. I busted out laughing when I saw it. McDonald's had this, the Burger, it was Burger King commercial, with a Big Mac on a podium.
Mm-hmm.
And the person was saying, you're free, like the Big Mac is free, buy one, get one free, basically. But they were just saying, you're free. So when they freed the slaves in America, the slaves didn't know any place but the place they had been on all those years. So if you're free, where are you going to go if you don't know anywhere else, if you don't know anywhere else? So that's why they stayed on the plantation and worked for a little bit of nothing, because there was no other alternative except for the one out of three that migrated west.
Mm.
So
I agree with that.
So making it doesn't mean that you made it. Making it mean you arrived at your partial destination.
I agree. I absolutely agree. And I think, what was it somebody posted on Facebook this week that said if you take a cage bird, thinks that there's something wrong with flying because he's never been out of cage. You know what I'm saying? So, hey, he doesn't understand freedom. So if you open the door, he probably won't even go outside of it because all he knows is the cage. And so to agree with you, AJ, yes, I agree. I absolutely agree.
And you know what? Just quickly, okay. I saw a post where it was a stallion, and the stallion had been conditioned that when his the bridle that was in his mouth on the reins was tied on the post, you know, he would just be there. But someone did a study, and they took the same leash and they just laid it on top of the post. They didn't even tie it. The horse wouldn't move because the horse still thought he was tied up and that he could see that it was not tied up, but in his mind, he was so used to what he had envisioned that he probably never even thought that would ever happen. So he still wouldn't move because he's been conditioned.
And I thought
I was getting ready to say something similar because, you know, I've been going to the circus since I was a little boy. And I used to go back there, and they, you know, if you go early, they let you go back and see animals where they are and the stalls and talk to people. And I remember this guy telling me that the way they train the elephant is when they first get the elephant has this big giant chain around his neck, this big, and three or four stakes in the ground. So the elephant spends days, every time he wakes up, spend days tugging on that chain, trying to break loose. And then later on, you know, after a couple of weeks, they put a smaller chain on him, still a stake in the ground. He tried to pull and he'd give up. After a while, they can put a rope around it and a stake in the ground, and the elephant would just stand there. So I'm saying, just imagine all these tons of muscle that no longer move because they don't think they can get away. That is us.
Yeah.
We are the ones tied. We are the ones still hanging on to Jim Crow.
Because you know what? It's in our minds. You're right. You're absolutely. We have not freed our minds, so therefore we can't move forward. Because, you know, someone was saying to someone that I'm friends with on Facebook, they were the person owns their own TV show, and they make their money through advertising. Someone said, well, why you paying for a show? Why don't you get you a show where somebody pay you? And so the guy says, listen, because I want to be my own boss. So if I get my money through advertisers, then I get a chance to make the rules, and I don't have to abide by anybody else's rules, and it's my kingdom, as opposed to me working and building somebody else's kingdom. And the person that they were talking to couldn't even figure out what he was talking about. He was like, you know, but I still don't know why you just don't go work for somebody. You got all this talent. So you're right, it's in our minds that we must work for somebody, that we, you know, that we should never be owners, that we should always be, you know, I guess borrowers or something. I don't know. But when I saw that, I was just flabbergasted.
Carrie, I am a poet. I write. And I perform everywhere. I host events. I do all these other things. And it's so interesting that now everybody's a poet that ever wrote anything. So the market's kind of diluted because you have people that don't want to pay the price for a good poet. They just want a poet to come out so they can say we had a poet because it's that popular thing now. You know, I got a Twitter account. I got 8 followers, you know. You know, so it's that popular thing. But I'm saying when you host and when you do other things and people see what you do, they say, wow, I've never heard anything like that because everybody else they hired didn't try and perform and hone their craft to be the best they can be because there has to be an evolution in whatever you do to be better.
Y'all, we got to be better. We got to be better. Yeah, we got to move on. We got a lot of ground to cover too. It is almost the top of the hour, and y'all, we got a lot to cover tonight. We want to talk about next the NSA spying on. Wow is World of Warfare. You guys probably play video games. I don't. I know what Xbox is, but I was not familiar with WoW. And so they said that the NSA is spying on WoW and Xbox Live players. Why would they be doing that, y'all?
But see, what it is they have this.
So we are WoW.
Okay. Now what it is, it's they have a Kinect unit. And see, when the Kinect unit initially came out, you could just sign on, create your account, and sign on just like having a Gmail account or an email account, where it was free.
Okay.
But the new Xbox One is coming out. There's a fee. See, what you can do is when you sign on, all your friends could sign on, so y'all could play the same game together and have a headset on and be talking to each other back and forth and playing the war games or the Mortal Kombat games or whatever. Now, the Xbox One, you have to pay a monthly fee for that service. It's only like $3.99 or whatever it is. But see, the thing is when you look at the millions that they sold on the N-word Thursday or N-word Friday, whichever one you want to call Black Friday, okay, let's say Black Friday. See, you look at the millions that they sold, and now you have 1 million people getting ready to pay, let's say, $3.99 a month. So at the end of the year, if that's $4 a month, that's $48 a year times how many millions of people that bought the unit.
But what does that have to do with why you're spying on me, though?
But the point is the Kinect unit is where you connect to the Internet.
Okay.
So it's already been proven that if you can turn it on and connect to the Internet can turn it on and connect with you.
See, this is what it says. It says GCHQ and NSA targeted online games and communities, including World of Warcraft and Xbox Live, as part of their anti-terrorism activity. This is the latest revelation from Edward Snowden's leaks. He was the ex-NSA employee that is now, in Russia? I think he's in Russia now. And so this is part of what he leaked. So my thing is this. Now, this is my conspiracy theory for the night. If you are playing some of those shooting, are some of these games shoot 'em, bang,
yeah,
bang kind
of? All of them.
Okay.
They're pretty much violent and that they have the higher rating and all that.
Okay, imagine, now this is just me, y'all. This is my conspiracy theory thinking mind. Imagine you're that guy who wins all the time at those kind of games. That kind of says something about your personality. I don't know what, but it says something about your personality. So imagine they say this guy would be a great Manchurian candidate. I'm just saying, y'all. That's just my theory.
That's not a theory. I'm saying 10 years ago, there's a movie called The Last Starfighter. And the whole concept of the movie, the upright games used to have, like the Pac-Man games, there was an upright game that they had, and they was like, if you get to whatever this point is, you beat the game and the game will give you this big prize. So when the guy spent all these weeks and all these nights playing the game, when he finally beat the game, the spaceship landed down and said, okay, we need you because you're the last starfighter. So what you're saying is, what you said was already in the movie 20 years ago, so it's nothing new.
Okay.
When you think about it, I know we were talking about the Patriot Act, and we were talking about some things before, but really because of this technology, I mean, there's some articles out about the Navy that had been doing some research and development. They're calling it cyber espionage because basically, I mean, this particular game, the Kinect aspect of it, said it was the fastest-selling consumer electronic device. I said they sold a total of 8 million units in the first 60 days. So, and the Navy and others, I mean, it probably doesn't take that much to hack into a system to then anybody who has not only the game but also has the Kinect, they can monitor wherever that game is because you have to go online to play. AJ was saying, so it has larger implications, and it's not just to kind of occasionally see who. I mean, this is something that they can use with whoever is online.
Because you got to think about when they create these games, they have to get inside of your mind a little bit to understand who's going to like my game and what do they want from my game and what will make them spend hours and hours playing my game. That said, when you get on their game and master their game, they pretty much know who you are.
Mm-hmm.
Would you agree with that? Say what?
No, they're beta testers.
Yes.
What they do with the beta testers, they find people that like the game, and they pay people to play the game. I'm saying there are people making over $100,000 a month right now, young people. They got a house for themselves. I was just looking at one in California. It's like eight people in California live in this house, and they're trying to master this game because if they master that game, they get so much more money. Okay. But they're paying them to play the game. And there's people all over the world.
Go ahead.
There's a group in China that masters the game that they watch. They have shows where these people go to play the game, and people will pay in an arena to see them on these big screens play this game.
Yep.
You know, this is the thing I think, y'all. Be careful. I mean, you know, if you're spending 20 hours a week playing Xbox, you might need to find you something else to do. I mean, because we're living in a different kind of world, and they're spying on you to see what you're playing and you know, the activities that you're dealing with or the games that you're playing are always violent. It speaks to your personality. And there are people right now, I think, and this is my conspiracy thinking mind again, but I think there's people that look and prey on people who they can use as pawns when they have ulterior motives to do bigger. Well, how do I want to put this, y'all? I think I'm trying to say, again, men candidates.
Well, just use a different analogy. Like, you know, back in the day, the drug dealer would get the 12-year-old or the 11-year-old to take this bag down the street and deliver it and bring it back because if the 12-year-old got busted, he just goes, you know, he can go to jail. So that's the same thing. You have somebody that has a little bit of knowledge about something, and you're giving them something big to play with. Now, they don't know the implications or the final ramifications of what they're doing. So they're just caught up in the game.
And see, yo, pay attention to all these mass shootings. It's always somebody was pay attention to the personality types. Rarely is it somebody who was bubbly and outgoing and had a whole lot of friends. It's always somebody who had, you know, either been that way and had, as of late, been, like, really isolated, acting really strange, on a whole lot of medication, you know, that deals with, you know, personality disorders. You know, so you have to really pay attention to what you're putting out there, the information you want the world to know about you. So all these people that do these mass shootings, you know, the Boston, you know, situation, you know, they kind of pick you out because of something that you're doing. And so saying that to say these games, like I said, spending 20 hours a week or 30 hours a week or 40 hours a week is not a good idea. Maybe it's like time to do something else, maybe do some yard work or get another job or do something. But it's just not smart after looking at this story for anybody to be spending that much time online perfecting these games because, you know, while you're having a good time, somebody looks like they could possibly be targeting you. That's just my thought on that. Y'all have any other comments on that particular story?
Well, I thought they have the personality disorder because everybody, if you're up at night from midnight to 5 in the morning, all you see is all these medications that would clear your sinuses but stop
But it'll do what? Did we lose AJ?
Yeah.
Okay. You said do what, AJ?
He was going in and out.
Yeah, AJ, I'm going to close your phone line up, and then we're going to come back in here. Okay, AJ, let's try it again. Say what? Okay, we've lost AJ. He's going to dial back in. We dropped him some kind of way. But you agree with that, Christopher, that you just probably shouldn't be allowing yourself to be out there like that off? I mean, that many hours a day, perfecting
the
game?
Sure, I don't think that is beneficial mentally or physically, but mainly mentally. And then, two, even though my kids do have the Xbox, I, as much as possible, monitor what they're playing, what I buy them in the first place, and then how long. And they don't actually even play the game on the weekday during school. But I still have to be very careful because too much of that can't be fruitful because a lot of times too much can make them think that's like reality and that because they're doing the hitting somebody and seeing blood or shooting somebody and so forth, and you have to be careful because children as well as adults can become desensitized. And then when they actually do something, they don't feel that, well, they're desensitized. So, yes, it's dangerous, and I think that I think you really have a problem if that's what you're doing, spending all those hours every day. And if you are, I mean, geez, are you working for a living or do you have any kind of life?
This is true. AJ, your phone line is back open. Your comment was what? AJ Houston. He is definitely having some problems with his phone line tonight. But one thing they found out, they said that they were doing this for anti-terrorism reasons. But what was found out when they did this was that basically they never found any anti-terrorist activity during their surveillance. So you really wonder, were they really doing it for the purposes that they said they were doing it? You know, because I'm trying to figure out how, first of all, why would you assume that you're going to find a terrorist playing Xbox 20 hours a week?
I think that goes back to kind of what AJ was saying. There is a fee, okay, but that's just a smokescreen. But the other thing is that it requires permanent internet connection. So what that does is that is feeding the mind of these individuals that buy these game systems that they already know before they get it that they're going to have permanent internet connection. So that's going to make a lot of money for the companies that provide internet service. But what that also does is that anybody that wants to hack into something, whether it's the government, in a lot of cases it will be, they can hack into anybody. And then guess what you do when you buy these games? You register them. You register them with your name, where you live at, and all these things. So they have access to that information as well. So it's not just they can actually, like espionage, they can view how many folks are in the room, what's going on, what household is that. They already know who own them. And if people don't have food to eat, they gonna have internet to play these games.
Some kind of way we're dialing into something. And so basically, and I agree with that 100%. And I think people do not realize and understand what they're dealing with. I absolutely agree. AJ, do we connect you back?
Yeah.
Okay. So you're.
I must have said something pretty important because they keep cutting my phone up. And Terry, I've been saying this for the last 10 years on my phone, and everybody thought I was joking. I was joking all the time.
You were saying what?
They're listening in. I was always saying, they listening in. Like homeless kids listening.
Is that what Bob was saying? So wait a minute, they said what?
Now, I'd always be saying that other people are listening on my phone calls when I was talking to people. They were laughing like, oh, man, you crazy. I'm like, no. But see, now everybody's finding out that they don't even know how long they've been listening to phone calls. It just came out that they're listening.
This is true. I agree. And, the thing is, they say, again, we've repeated this, I think, on two shows, that they say they're not listening to the content of the conversations. They're just looking at the numbers and the length of the conversation, which –
No, they're listening for keywords. So how do you listen for keywords and not listen to the conversation?
Yeah, that, now that's
I
a good one.
I don't understand that. I don't know how you do that.
Do what? Yeah, you do understand it. You know what time it is. No, did you complete your thought on it, though? Did you get a chance to complete your thought on the NSA?
I kind of thought it, but it kept cutting off, and I was like, I need to leave them alone.
That may be what they try to say. You just leave that one alone. Okay, y'all, you know, we're down to our last probably 45 minutes of the show, and I definitely want to get this one in. Okay, what did y'all think of the 16-year-old, very rich Texas teen that killed four people and maimed a fifth because he was driving drunk? And the Tarrant County judge gave him probation, for a 10-year probation.
I think it's just one that was in the paper.
Yes, that one.
No, I'm saying, listen to me now. I think it was just one that was in the paper. I'm not saying this is the only one.
Okay.
I'm saying this is one that made the paper.
Right, exactly. I agree. And, you know, the thing is, it really kind of reminds me of a story that happened in the same county in which two little boys about the same age went to rob a house that they thought was vacant. It was not vacant. They thought nobody was home, let's just say that. And what happened was the children that lived in the home happened to come home for lunch. It was a school day, and they happened to come home for lunch. When they went into the house, they noticed that somebody was in there. The girl ran out of the house. The brother, for whatever, confronted the burglars. And what happened was one of the teens that was robbing the house had a gun. And he shot and killed the kid that lived at the house. Well, the shooter or the boys that were robbing the house were black. The teen that was shot was white. That said, there was two shooters. I mean, I'm sorry. Let's start again. There was two robbers. Only one shooter, only one shot. But they were trying to charge them both with murder. The second kid said, listen, I admit I was there. I was robbing that house, but I didn't even know my friend had a gun, and I didn't know anybody was going to get killed. And they came on this show twice, and I don't know what the outcome of the story was, but the last time they came on, they were trying to charge that teen with murder. So I'm bringing up this story to say same county, black kid that were poor versus white kid with money. One person was killed that was white by one black boy. In this particular situation, this rich white kid kills four people and maims a fifth, and he gets off completely with nothing but probation. Was it fair?
Oh, no, it's not fair, but they were charging both black kids because association brings about a simulation. So we knew if you had a gun, you would have shot him too. You know, so that's where they were.
Let's just say I don't put everybody in my car, and I don't travel with a lot of folks. I mean, seriously, I'm pretty much a loner for that, you know, in that respect. But I think there are people that have been caught up in situations that they did not know things were going to go down until they got there. I really do believe that happened.
A friend of mine, his two sons, they were trying to give them 99 years each.
Wow.
Over here in Fort Worth, you know, at one time all these gas stations, little convenience stores were being robbed.
Mm-hmm.
And one of his sons was a model, dating my niece, and he worked out at Vault with me. But what happened is they were riding with two friends that came out and picked him up and said, man, I'm going to stop at the gas station. Guy walk in the gas station, come out, other guy drive off. Now, the man come out of the gas station, get the license plate, call in, they get stopped. So now they have all these, you know, all these robberies that they don't know who did, but they mm-hmm. stopped him. But the two guys that did the robbery said that these two brothers were the brains of the outfit. So now they're trying to charge them with every robbery that they didn't know who did, like every robbery was theirs.
But, and that's what I'm saying. I really can't believe that the situations happen. So let's just say, and I don't know, but this is just a story that they told on the show. Let's just say the second team didn't know that the first team was going to had brought a gun or was going, well, first of all, they didn't go there to kill anybody because they thought the house was empty. But let's just say the second team didn't know that the first team had the gun. So when the whole shooting thing occurred, it was like, wow, you know, this is happening. He's there, but to charge him with murder, isn't that stiff? You know, but that's just the way I think they do the law. But at the same time, this
It's stiff, but you got to keep this in mind. When the story in just about all of these cases where it involves where individuals are disproportionately being sentenced or vilified, it's in the hands of either the state's attorney or the district attorney.
Mm-hmm.
Thereby, and because the judge does not charge, the
mm-hmm.
judge basically only covers the proceedings. The police
mm-hmm.
arrest and somewhat supposed to investigate, they then turn it over to another agency that is the sole agency that has the ability to actually formal charge. Now, even when they charge you, that charge means nothing until they actually get an indictment. Once they
mm-hmm.
get the indictment, then the charge is full and fair. Now, I said all that to say is that you could commit a murder. 10 witnesses saw you do it. You go to court, they arrest you, you go to court, and then the state's attorney says, we don't want to charge him.
Mm-hmm,
well,
mm-hmm.
guess what? You don't get charged.
Right.
Now, it could be because a lot of reasons behind it in terms of, you know, they're in bed together, you know, in terms of the corruptness and so forth. But the bottom line becomes they then have the ability to interpret the law the way they want to because nobody can force the district or the state's attorney to charge. And in this case with this 16-year-old, what happened is that the district attorney is the one that decided not to charge him or basically to give him 10 years probation because they said in all the other cases of someone who's high on alcohol, drugs, and so forth, and they basically commit
It was a judge, wasn't it?
What I'm saying is that it is the district or the state's attorney, if they don't fight it, then whatever way the judge, and that's what I'm saying, it's usually between the person who has the authority to charge them.
Right.
The state's attorney doesn't
send
you. They only charge you, but they can make a recommendation that you not be charged or that your sentence is commuted or whatever the case is, no matter what the crime is. And if the judge agrees with it and if it's a bench trial, it'll go that way.
Okay, let's talk about
But he was affluent. So to me, his parents, they had money, and there were some other things that went on that are not in the public view, and they determined that they were not going to charge him. But we do know, had that been a African-American male 16-year-old, he would have been charged as an adult, and we know what would have happened.
And, you know, we're talking about the story of – we're talking about Ethan Couch, right? So we're talking about the 16-year-old out of Tarrant County, Texas.
Yes, whose blood alcohol level was 3 times the legal limit. Yep.
Right. Sure. He killed 4 people. He maimed the 5th. And the prosecutor, I understand, asked for 20 years behind bars. And by the way, the difference in these two stories that I told you, the black kids that were 16 were charged as adults in the same county where this kid did this, they did this under the juvenile system. Go figure. And they said that the judge is the one that said she didn't want him to go to jail because he was suffering from, what was it, affluenza, which is
basically you
so rich, you stupid.
You don't know right from wrong because your parents let you do everything you wanted to.
When do they ever say you're so poor? You know what I'm saying? That you didn't know any better. That you didn't have any proper upbringing.
They said it all the time, Carrie. That's why they sent us them.
Carrie, let me give you just a brief, quick example. Going back to my case. Now, as I stood in a cell in bond court, waiting for the judge to tell me what my bond was going to be, there was a white gentleman who I could probably tell his family had some money.
Mm-hmm.
So he goes up to the judge because it's a monitor. You're not in the courtroom. It's just a monitor in the jail cell. And basically they talked about his case. And what he had done, he was on drugs and so forth. Now, he robbed an individual at knife point.
Mm-hmm.
But his previous felony was robbing somebody at gunpoint. So he
mm-hmm.
had a history of basically robbing people. The mm-hmm. judge decided to give him an I bond, and an I bond is where the state pays for your bail.
Mm-hmm.
And they let him go.
See.
I came up after the fact, never having been in trouble with the law, and the allegations were frivolous against me, and the judge said, if I could, I would make your bail higher, and he set my bail at $50,000.
So you see the disparity.
I mean, I knew then. I mean, I didn't know, but once that had happened, I understand the story, and it's basically cut. It's open and closed. This is what happens when you have money and or influence, and you're white.
Well, you know, the color of justice is green. We get that. But I think the problem is, you know, we as black people don't want to seem like we want to fight for criminals. So we don't ever push the system back when we see, you know, injustice in the justice system. We don't say, hey, that's just wrong. And we feel like we got to either start voting some of these judges out or we got to, you know, vote to change some laws. We don't ever jump on those things because we don't want to look like we're a community that would fight for an injustice of a person who committed a crime. You know what I'm saying? That's what it seems to be about. You know, I think it took a long, long time for them to say, is something wrong with the fact that a person who sells crack cocaine and a person who sells white powder cocaine are being, you know, looked at in the system differently? It took us a long time to say something's wrong with that.
Well, something is wrong with that, and that's why the reason they want to change it is because now too many white folks are getting caught up into that. Now it's an issue. Now they want to reconsider that disparaging inequality of sentencing for crack versus cocaine. But prior to that, it's kind of like as long as it's going on in the black neighborhood, fine. But when it spill over into the white neighborhood, oh, no, now there's a problem.
I saw where on one of those shows, and I don't watch a lot of TV, I must admit, but this was a while back when they had a reality show about meth addicts. And I happened to catch an episode of it, and I, be honest with you, I've never met anybody that I knew personally that did meth. And I was surprised at what it does to your body. However, crack does some bad things to your body, too. And the judge looked at this person who had committed a number of crimes, you know, to support their meth habit. And the judge said, you know, I don't want to give you jail time because that methamphetamine has really done a number on you, you know. So, you know, I'm just gonna let you off easy because, you know, I think you suffered enough. And I thought, when do they say that to a crackhead? I mean, you know what I'm saying? I mean, and y'all take that in the spirit in which I'm saying that, but that didn't seem fair to me, that just because they looked at the fact that the person had the shakes and whatever other side effects that you get when you're coming down off meth, and they looked like, you know, they were, you know, one foot in, what is it, how do they say, one foot on the grave and the other one on the banana peel, I don't know. They just looked really bad, that the judge gave them a lighter sentence. And I thought, that's not fair. But that's how the system does. And we never stand up and say something's wrong with the system and demand change. We always talk about it, as I said on the show before, we be on the porch talking about it. And all we're going to do is be porch talkers. And we never get off the porch and say, you know what, or off the corner and say, you know, we need to go to the polls. We need to elect the right people to fight for change in the justice system because we make up too big of a number of the people that are being incarcerated. The prison industrial complex has the majority of us in it, and all of us ain't guilty. And if some of us are guilty, they're giving us stiffer sentences than they should. And a lot of it, y'all, it is even coming down to classism. I saw a lady today on the news locally here who got 70 years for stealing Christmas supplies. I mean, Christmas decorations. They caught her stealing Christmas decorations, and they found out that she had priors. And the prior was for going to someone's garage and stealing a weed eater and a blower. And so the judge said, I'm going to make an example out of you. And he gave her 70 years, and she was appeared to be a poor white woman. And I thought to myself, like, wow, 70 years for petty crimes, and you just let the teen off with 10 years of probation? Something's wrong with the system.
Well, and that's what's called, to me, that's a police state short of being martial law. I mean, at that point, color is going to be irrelevant when they want to crack down on what they perceive is not necessarily a threat, but if they perceive it as being a crime or something that can no longer be tolerated. And then this is why, I mean, I can go to my barber at the barbershop, and they'll talk politics and talk crime and who's doing what all day long. But then as soon as I pull out a petition and say, well, sign this petition for me, my brother, my sister, then nobody want to be bothered with that. Oh, no, I don't want to get involved. I don't want to do it. So now they revert back to that house Negro mentality. But people, by and large, in the black community, it's kind of like what you said earlier and what AJ is saying. When you put them to the litmus test of actually standing up to fight injustice, period, people just seem like they easily get fatigued, and most people just don't want to get involved.
Well, you know,
no back.
Don't we always roll out with, I got tickets, you know what I'm saying, or I would, but I had a case or something, you know, like,
yes,
like wow.
Yes.
So just because you got some tickets or you had a case, you can't ever put your name on a petition or fight for nothing? I don't want them to get my license plate number. Yeah. Really?
Yeah.
But that's what it seems to boil down to. AJ, would you agree with that?
Well, basically, but I think what it is we are the most, I guess, non-involved people.
Yeah.
We were involved in the dialogue, but not in the action. Until you hear it on the radio and everybody, you know, because Drake going to be there. You know, somebody else going to be there, so you're going to go and I went and hung out with Drake. And forget you as Gina Six.
Mm-hmm.
You know, forget what the cause is. You just going for the people.
And, you know, the sad part about it is, I'm going to put this out there. When something like what happened to Rodney King happened, everybody ran down there and said, you know, I'm going to jump in and I'm going to do something. Tearing up a city after the fact is just stupid. I mean, that's reactionary. You know, we need to be proactive. You know, I mean, because it doesn't make any sense after something happens like a Rodney King situation, then we get so mad, we ready to go do something stupid. That just seems like what we do. Y'all agree? Would y'all agree with that? That's how we respond.
I agree, but I'm saying you even know that you can post the simplest thing on your Facebook page and have 87 people like it. But you post the most prolific item on your page, 3 people click on because other people are afraid to.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Well, and that's true. And you can't, it just seems like, I mean, I thought I was, I guess, a mediocre advocate that I would get involved in causes, sign petitions, and so forth. And I will say that I became more heightened in terms of getting involved in social issues that mean a lot just because of the fabric, social fabric that we live in. But I have come to find out that also, too, when you start talking truth, not he said, she said, but things are factual, even when those same people find out what you're talking is the truth, and if they would get involved, that then increases the chances to make a push for advocacy and change for everybody, people that they become more lackluster in terms of pursuing that because people are not willing, they will own what they want to own. Now, if you said, hey, I'll give you a Jay-Z ticket or Jay-Z's coming to town, hey, they'll break their neck. Beyonce going to be there? They'll be there. But you say A.J. Houston, Keira Hines, she's going to be there, and they're going to be putting out some good information that'll help our socioeconomic condition. They don't want to hear that, and very few people will show up. So
I'm agreeing with you. I think in a lot of cases, unfortunately, especially with what we got going on in this country right now, black folks won't know until the bomb hits the house. Because we ain't going to pick up a newspaper. We ain't, you know, basically we know what's on TV and in the newspaper for the most part. It's propaganda. But after you read the newspaper long enough and you listen to the news long enough, you can see BS propaganda coming. And so I think you'll learn to go and seek out your own answers. But you got to start somewhere. And I think we're just paying attention.
Jared, I'm working on a new poem, and one of the lines I wrote in the poem today, it says, truth is a liar's worst fear.
Truth is a liar's worst fear.
Okay.
I agree.
But I'm saying, but this is in the context of a poem, but that's one line I was just thinking about on the conversation we're having. Because, see, liars would like to be around other liars so they can tell bigger lies.
Yeah.
But liars around a person speaking the truth, then they say, oh, man, I got to go watch grass grow. Man, I have to go window shop. It's going to go do nonsensical things because it's like, man, I can't be around all this truth, man. I'm not used to that.
Well, you know what, how someone put it the other day, and I really didn't look at it like this until they said it. You know, we are so deep in denial right now. I think when you see all the craziness going on and people around us seem like they're snapping like twigs, I mean really literally snapping like twigs, and you go, well, wow, that was strange for them to do it. What made them do that? I don't know if it's something in the atmosphere that's causing people to go crazy or if it's just, you know, hereditary. I don't know. But people are snapping. And someone came up with this, and they said, is it because people – deep down know that something is wrong, but they don't want to deal with it. So it's easier to turn on a reality show or listen to a Judge Judy show or play with your Xbox than really deal with the reality that our country is in trouble and something bad is about to jump off, whether that's World War III or the dollar is fit to collapse or whatever is fit to go down. We all know something bad is fit to happen. But those who have either been dumbed down so far that they don't really get it, or somewhere inside they know that something's bad is going to happen, they just aren't willing to deal with it, don't want to deal with it.
Well, I think what it is, Gary, is if we've been helpless for so long, we've gotten used to it.
You might be right. You might be right. Christopher, you agree with that?
Yeah, I do agree with that. I think that's hands down the truth, and it's a long-standing several hundred years of the slavery, the treatment, the mentality, the emotional, the psychological aspects that go along with that. Yes, in a sense, we're not slaves in chains back down on the farm, but at the same time, some people still have that mentality, and genetically, some of that has been passed on, but I think that some people have become so used to not having to fight. I know the a lot of this generation that they don't know any better. And so when someone who's coming along who's basically, they're not trying to peddle snake oil, but they're trying to give you some good information, trying to give you some good advice, they're trying to tell you, hey, well, even if you don't believe me, do some research on your own. And a lot of folks, I'll post something on Facebook, they'll say, oh, and some of my white counterparts called me a racist. And I was just talking about the disparity of sentencing and the prison industrial complex. And when I could actually encourage them, and then they actually went and did the research, they either called me or they sent me an inbox and they said, hey, keep on fighting. Because then what they did is that they're saying, I actually know what the truth is, I'm not really going to get involved, but at least they're acknowledging that what I put was the truth, and it wasn't fantasy.
And you know, and I agree with that. I saw some of that with the Trayvon Martin. You know, I did several shows on Trayvon Martin, and we did almost like a weekly for like 6 weeks or 7 weeks on what was going on. And I really literally got flack from white people on Facebook that had never said anything to me. They were like, you know what, why don't you just get over it? I mean, I was like, really? You know, and then I even had some people that I thought I knew pretty well on Facebook say, and they were Caucasian, and they said, you know, Carrie, we think you're changing. This story has changed you. We really thought you were a little bit more open-minded and a little bit less biased, but you're being real biased on this story, and we're going to unfriend you. And I was like,
Now,
do
they
kind of
thought you were a passive, good house Negro who wasn't going to stir up and cause no trouble. It's like, yes, sir, master, I's be good Negro. I ain't going to cause no trouble. See, and a lot of my friends, I think they actually picture me like that because being passive aggressive, kind of quiet, don't really, and then when you start saying stuff that makes them uncomfortable, and it's making them uncomfortable because it's the truth. Now, some is because they didn't know. Others knew, but now it's kind of like when they didn't want the slaves to be able to read and write. Well, there was a reason for that.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was surprised because I do call myself somebody who's typically not biased. I'm really not. But one thing I'll do on Center Stage is I'll tell you what I think. And so I think I was surprised that they were surprised that I would tell them what I thought about what happened with the Trayvon Martin situation. And I was very surprised that six of them at one time all ganged up on me on one post and said, you know what, we think you being biased and we don't want to be your friend anymore. And I was like, see y'all, you know. And I didn't inbox them and ask them to come back because I really thought they had put me into a category where they thought that I would only say certain things. And obviously they thought that I wouldn't tell the truth when I thought that a black person had been wrong, and that's just not who I am. I have white followers and I have black followers, and I like everybody, and I'm not racist at all. But if I see a black person doing something wrong, I'm going to say it. And if I see a white person doing something wrong, I'm going to say it. That's just how I do it here. And so, they left, and, you know, I don't even miss them. But that was just something that happened, you know, as a result of me carrying the Trayvon Martin series for about 6 or 7 weeks. But moving on, y'all, listen, I got to talk about the Mandela Memorial. Listen, I thought this was funny. I mean, even though I know, you know, Mandela died and he, you know, was a great, great warrior, you know, in the struggle. But I got to talk about the guy who was interpreting when President Obama and some of the other dignitaries was up there. What was up with the dude who was signing, who really wasn't signing? What happened there? How did he get clearance? And what is really going on?
Terry, he actually knows sign language. I'm saying, he has some mental issues, but I don't think that. I think when you're signing a different language, there's a difference. I'm saying, I go to the National Poetry Slam Championship every year, and we have people that sign for slam poems, and I'm saying, yeah, poets speaking real fast. But there's some guys that can sign, and some might miss a word or two, which make it seem like the whole conversation is off. And when I first heard it, I was shocked because I was thinking that somebody snuck in like the couple did at the White House. But this guy actually had a job doing sign language.
Okay, now I can go there with you to a point, but his explanation didn't make any sense. When the story broke, this is his explanation, and this doesn't make any sense to me. Okay, this guy says, I really do know how to do this. However, he said, well, I'm looking for my notes here. He said, the man that was doing the sign language said that he was suffering from schizophrenic episodes, and he was hallucinating. Come on now. How the heck can you be suffering from schizophrenic episodes? And
Terry,
at the same time, so he was hearing voices and he was hallucinating. Dude, you should have left.
I'm not going to dispel it totally, but I understand what you're saying. But I'm saying, Terry, you know what the most fearful job in the world is?
What? Standing up in front of people?
No, public speaking.
Right.
And I'm saying you can do sign, but when you do sign and now you know 100 million people watching, it's a whole different concept.
You know what, AJ, and I can go there with you to a point. Y'all, you know what? I do this every week, and every week I have jitters before I come up. Every single week. I mean, and I am so on top of my product knowledge 99% of the time, but even having all the information in front of me, I get nervous. But that's part of it because I would be being real cocky if I wasn't. So, and you do public speaking, and the major has people who follow him, and he does public speaking, but at the same time, you know I know him, Christopher knows, it is a time to leave the stage when
oh, yeah.
you don't have it all together.
Terry, I have a friend that's the coldest poet I know. When she first started doing poetry, she used to get on stage and hyperventilate.
And I'm saying,
have the courage to get up there and get ready, went over the piece, ready for it and everything, and get up there and hyperventilate. And it's just a mind thing, really. But now she's the coldest poet you ever seen on stage.
I heard T.D. Jakes, and everybody knows how great of a speaker T.D. Jakes is. T.D. Jakes said when he first started out, he had to hold his hands behind his back because they would be shaking so bad. But finally, of course, he mastered it because we see him all the time now, and he ain't shaking. But so that's part of it. But this guy's saying, I'm hearing voices. I'm hallucinating. I mean, seriously. Come on, how are you going to sit out there in front of the world? I don't believe it. I don't know
when you're going to sit on stage and have the TV cameras on you, knowing 100 million people watching, and know you're messed up, you got people telling you what you need to say.
Well, you know, and I think it's and I don't know who at what point knew, but apparently there's one or two individuals that are actually deaf that's in the African Parliament government, and just people in general during the funeral. They were actually tweeting and sending different messages, and I think even some of the individuals in the consulate got that, saying, hey, look, I'm a professional signer, and this garbage. This is that. So I don't know at what point they could have, I guess, appropriately pulled him out and put somebody else in. And then a lot of other individuals that dependent because they read sign language said that they lost out because he wasn't really signing. So yeah, they're investigating it, and it is odd. But I don't think we have all the information yet. But I think at some point, because the ceremony was so long, and that for whatever reason, that whether he was nervous or this or that, I think, you know, like in the movies when that cane comes out and they yank you off the stage, they should have done something probably appropriately, get him off the stage and get somebody else up there.
And so I'm not trying to make an excuse for him totally. I'm not trying to make an excuse. I'm just saying that I've seen people do things, and I'm saying in his case, I think he had talked to some people as far as – because if you notice, the company that hired him is no longer in existence. They can't find anybody that – they can't find the company. That's not the people that ran it.
Exactly. And you know what? Let me piggyback off that. In 2012, he signed for President Jacob Zuma at the ruling ANC party's 100th anniversary celebration in 2012. And the South African government, let me back up. When he did that, there were complaints about him. When he did that particular event, there was complaints. And so now the South African government has come out on Thursday and admitted that this man was not a professional sign language interpreter. So tell me, how is it that this guy could have got that job? I mean, I do think this was like the party crasher.
No, it wasn't a party crasher, Terry. There was a company. I'm saying the company has disappeared. The owner
right,
of the company
exactly.
There's no women.
Nobody even knows the name of the
company.
Okay.
I can't remember the name of it, but I'm saying I read this last night, and it was actually on Rachel Maddow, too, where the company disappeared. They can't find the company. They can't find anybody that worked in the company or ran the company. So it's not just him.
Isn't that suspicious?
No, I'm saying, Carrie, this is one of the biggest things around the world.
Yeah. Oh, I agree. I'm just saying, you know, I just thought that was odd. And so, you know, I don't know. And the truth will eventually probably surface. But I just found it odd that a person who basically does not have a the South African government said he's not a professional signer. So who hired him? How did he
get it?
Huh?
They have to say it now. They have to say it now because you messed up. You know,
they make him look bad.
In America, if they send you overseas and they say, okay, if you get caught, we don't know.
Okay, I can go there. I can absolutely go there. Let me piggyback one more thing on that story, and we're going to move on. It has come out, and some people are reporting, and y'all, and I kind of mentioned this last week, and y'all just kind of blew me off, like y'all didn't know what I was talking about. Conspiracy theories are back at it again this week, y'all. They're saying President Mandela did not die recently, that he died back in June, and that he has been on life support since June because there was a huge lawsuit against his estate. So they had allegedly kept him on life support until recently. You know, so do y'all believe that his family would keep him on life support almost 6 months? I mean, stranger things have happened.
Well,
I mean...
It wouldn't be beyond that. Some families may choose to do it. I mean, some families do it because of that financial. They're trying to work other things out. Sometimes people are trying to covertly do something because they don't agree with the will that's in place. I mean, I would have to do some more research, but, I mean, if it is true, it wouldn't be far-fetched that his family or any other family may do that for the sake of that. Not to say it's right,
but you don't have to think of the legal ramifications of it. If you're dead and somebody settles your estate or settles a lawsuit, you know, for your estate, that's going to be one thing. But I guess if you're still technically considered living, maybe, you know, there it would be settled a different way. So they're saying
true.
that was what was going on. Don't
well,
know.
Right. I mean, I don't know enough to know if that's, you know, if it leads more towards this, that that's what actually happened. It's kind of what you're saying. I mean, sometimes they're doing that to buy time to get things ironed out so that it's not total chaos because the person may have indemnified or willed certain things but didn't take care of other things. So, I mean, I don't really know. I'm sure that he had quite a bit in terms of assets. And so there probably was some uncertainty about what was going to happen in terms of with his family. And then, I mean, if everybody was on the same page, it probably would have went down the way that he wanted. But we know in any given family, it doesn't always happen that way, even when there's a will in place. People contest.
Absolutely.
How long was James Brown and out?
No,
I'm serious.
Yeah, what is it, the father soul? What they call him? In the yeah, he was in there. I think they left him in there like 6 months. I mean, that's not funny, AJ. You should not have brought that up.
I'm not trying to make a joke. I'm saying the same, you know, the family circumstances would determine what actually goes on.
That
just like
me
the James Brown thing. You know, his family was fighting over so much money that they couldn't even decide where to bury him.
This is true. This is a good example.
They couldn't decide, you know, to pull the plug or when to pull the plug or what was actually going on to pull the plug.
Money, assets, royalties, just so probably laden, you know, hidden money, but, you know, yeah, just so many things going on. I mean, it's
–
it can become a friend.
You know, people lie about wills, you know. He had this will. He didn't have that will. Doctored wills. All types of things happen when people die, y'all. Trust me. And, y'all, listen, we're down to our last almost 10 minutes of the show, and we got to talk about this last story. I think we may be able to get to another one. Just depends. The New York mayor Michael Bloomberg, and Christopher, you got to weigh in on this because Christopher actually is a doctor's assistant, so he can tell us a little bit more about this. Bloomberg is saying that he wants mandatory flu shots for kids 3 to 5. So he's saying if your child is in the daycare system in New York City, he wants them it's mandatory that they get a flu shot. Is that fair?
It's not fair, but it's according to which side you're on because I know my granddaughter got lice from the daycare she was in. And one of my grandsons got almost whooping cough or whatever they call it. I don't know what the medical name of it is.
Pertussis, whooping cough, right.
Yeah, but they were saying that they wanted all these people, just like a couple of schools earlier this year where they got meningitis over here in Richardson or wherever it was, a couple of students had meningitis. So a lot of times it's according to the region. So I don't think that it should be mandatory that you get any shot. But I think if you're in a certain system and you see this is blatant and it's going on where other people can actually be affected, you really have to do something. So I think we always go to extreme measures to try and get it done or make our point, I guess, make our point more than anybody else's point, than anybody else want to say. So I don't think you should mandatory get flu shots, because I don't get them anymore. Because in the Army, you had to get every shot they gave you. It was just we were the test subjects for every shot they're giving you. You just lined up, and they had all these different people, all these different stations to where you go and get. We might get 8 shots today, 4 in each arm, and you don't even know what it is. They would tell you, but after 8, you don't even know what it is. But see, the thing is they would consider the percentage of people that actually got sick from the shot on how effective it was.
Christopher,
so
what do you think?
The vaccinations, okay, they are important, but it's kind of one of those things, and I'm in agreement with AJ. I think that there should be constitutionally, if an individual chooses not for the child to have it, then they should not be forced to. Now, the problem becomes is that then when you have the public system, you have preschools, daycares, and so forth like that, there's a state or federal requirement that's usually given by the Department of Public Health or the Center for Disease and Control. So usually based on those recommendations and whatever research and studies they've done and so forth, they usually make that recommendation, and then the politicians craft a legislation to make it a law. I mean, it's hard for me to kind of go against what the mayor is saying, simply because most of these the school settings that those children would be in are probably, well, they're public settings. Some might be private, but most of them are public settings. So what could inherently happen is that if you then allow people to selectively say, well, if you're going to come to this institution, you don't have to, or we're going to make it voluntary, you can do it or you don't have to do it. If there should be some type of outbreak, then what he's doing, because this is I'm going to be honest, it's not really so much from a health perspective. It's from a legal and lawsuit perspective. And so they're trying to keep the city out of being sued, because if something happens because someone had whooping cough or they had this, and then you could trace back that they could voluntarily not have had to have the vaccination, although the vaccination may not have been what would have protected in the first place. This is more about lawsuits, more about big dollars where people could be sued for stuff. So he's kind of going on what his surgeon is telling him, what his folks from the health department is telling him, and that's kind of where he's kind of stuck in the middle. He's probably going to stick more towards what's going to keep the city insulated from being sued versus not.
But they already get vaccinations. These same kids already get vaccinations for measles, whooping cough, chicken pox, and mumps. So then you're going to put flu shots on top of it? I mean, because most of the time my research found that the flu vaccination doesn't help kids. So this is the 10 things that we found out about flu shots that are dangerous. So you all decide for yourself. So I just question if it's, you know, something else behind this, because this is there's no
well,
evidence.
Well, it's money.
Carrie, the one thing you said is your research.
My research.
See, now we're back to the point. You said your research shows. See, now we're back to the point. See, you know, just like the graphs and all the charts and things that come out, I can make a chart to make my point, regardless of what the facts are.
Well,
you know, you
I
see
tell
this
you
all
what,
the time.
And he's right, because you know what? The flu vaccination is not a shelved product. In other words, there are other vaccinations, like for smallpox, you can keep that on the shelf, and it has an expiration, and you can pull it and use it anytime within that expiration period, and you're good to go. Influenza, the flu shot, is not. They make it at a specific time. That's why when they run out, unless somebody else has any more, they don't make any more.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of like a money-driven thing. I mean, so basically I think they start making influenza vaccine May-June time frame, and then they start inoculations probably sometime in August, and then it probably goes through January, and then it ends. So when they run out, there is no more.
And every year the strain changes.
Yeah.
The strain changes every year, so you can't get the same flu shot last year this year.
They said that there's 10 reasons flu shots are dangerous. Number one, no evidence that young children even benefit from flu shots. Number two, vaccines can actually lead to serious health problems. It makes your body more susceptible to disease. Number three, vaccinated children within days or a few weeks develop runny noses, pneumonia, ear infections, and bronchitis. Number four, if you have a suppressed immune system, it makes you more susceptible to pneumonia and other contagious diseases. Number five, flu vaccines contain mercury, and that's hazardous to your health if you didn't know that. Number six, mounting evidence that flu shots causes Alzheimer's.
Allie Robinson?
Yeah.
Her son.
Yeah. Number seven, yeah. It's all about money, y'all. They said the ACIP has financial interest in this. So if somebody, do you remember years back, y'all? Well, you may not know this, Christopher, but AJ knows this. Our good governor here, and I like Governor Perry, but Governor Perry tried to get everybody that was under a certain age that was like a, was it preteens, to get that, was it the HPIV shot? What was that called?
Yeah, I know what you're talking about. I can't remember what it's called, but, yeah, he was trying to pass that.
Yeah, he's taking everybody. Listen, he was trying to do exactly what this mayor is doing. And honest to God, they fought him so hard in Texas, he left that thing along. But the HPV shot, I think is what it's called, the human papilloma?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
He was trying to make all the preteens get that shot. And they were like, the mothers here in Texas and the fathers said, no, we're not going for that, and they had to stop. And so they said overuse of flu vaccines can cause them to mutate into more deadly strains.
The strain changes every year.
Exactly. Number nine, flu vaccines can cause neurological disorders. And then something about getting multiple shots. I don't know if I completed my thought there. But, you know, that's nine reasons, y'all, right there, where flu shots are questionable. So I think the issue becomes it should be an individual basis in which you decide you want your child to get a flu shot. That's just my thought on that. Y'all agree with that?
I think it definitely should be.
I'm in agreement, but I was just saying that when you have somebody gathering facts from whatever poll or whatever place you use, they're gathering facts for a specific purpose.
Right.
To solidify their argument.
And you, AJ is right, because you know what? Some people have been so inundated with that. If you told them, hey, I got this research, I got the copious amounts of information, documentation that can validate what I'm saying, they would almost stomp you to death because they would not believe you and they would still want to do the vaccine because it's like AJ said, they made the point, even though there's documentation and there's research out there, evidence, to say, well, okay, if you get it, fine, but it can cause these things. But if you don't get it, you're no more better or less off. There's some people that won't buy that because of they've made their point, and that's imprinted on people's brain, and so it's hard to change that.
And, yeah, you know what, make up your own mind, but I've never had a flu shot, and I don't ever intend to get one. I mean, so if I had kids, I probably wouldn't fine by that, I'm just saying, so you make up your own mind. Okay, y'all, that's got to be the word. Listen, thank you guys for hanging out with me tonight, AJ Houston and Christopher Bunn. Thank you so much. I had a great time, y'all. We talked about a lot of stuff. We covered a lot of ground about what's going on straight out of the news headlines, and we also covered the Federal Reserves. So listen, we do this each and every Friday night from 8 to 10 p.m. Central, 9 to 11 Eastern. Join us right here next Friday night. Tell a friend, tell a family member, tell a coworker to come and check out the show. Also, y'all, want y'all to drop me a line at centerstageradio@yahoo.com and let me know what you think of the show. I can take even constructive criticism. If y'all like to tell me that you hate the show and I need to change some things, I'd love to listen or at least dialogue with you about whether or not I agree. So send me a line at centerstageradio@yahoo.com. Also follow me on Facebook. I'm Carrie Hines on Facebook. And also on Twitter, I'm The Brains, T-H-A-B-R-A-I-N-Z on Twitter. If you all like to see us do a certain type show, also inbox me either on Facebook or send me something at my email address, centerstageradio@yahoo.com, and tell me what kind of shows you'd like to see Center Stage do. It's definitely something I would consider. Okay, y'all, I got to get out of here. But listen, thank you so much for listening tonight. Thank you, AJ and Christopher, for hanging out with me. I'll see you next week. Bye-bye.